It's May 6, 2005. House Committee on Trade, Economic Development will come to order. At this time, I'd like to open a work session, House Bill 2349.
Ripson Butler just walked in the room.
Okay. Well, can you explain what the 2349 does?
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2349 reduces the total cost requirement for exemptions from property taxes for eligible projects under the Strategic Investment Program. We had delivered to us late yesterday the Dash 2 amendments, which address the issues that were discussed when you met on this earlier in the week. And we are in the process of going through the Dash 2 amendments. Your staff is trying to determine specifically how it addresses the issues that were raised earlier in the week.
Okay, so we have a Dash 1 and Dash 2, or Dash 2 is combined all Dash 1?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that the Dash 2 replaces the Dash 1. The issue that was discussed was that there needed to be specific provisions addressing urban strategic investment programs versus rural strategic investment programs, and the Dash 2 addresses the rural strategic investment programs.
All right. So,
yeah, Economic and Community Development Department is here to speak on this if you would like to hear from them.
So who is next here?
Mr. Fish, yes.
Okay. Mr. Fisher, would you please come forward? Could you explain to us what the Dash 2 amendment does?
Director, my name is Arthur Fish, and it's all, as always, it's a pleasure to be here with you. What the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2349 do is essentially achieve the objective that the Vice Chair had done in the Dash 1s. It does, however, if you'll notice at the top of page 2, lines 2 and 3, it does sort of preserve or hold harmless, if you will, the effect of the bill as introduced with respect to rural areas, and essentially allow their threshold minimum to start at $12.5 million, currently $25 million in the law. And I can get into more of that then. Subsequent to that, line 4 and down would address the sliding scale as applicable in urban areas as envisioned in the Dash 1 amendments. And just briefly to explain, for smaller projects, the minimum threshold in these areas would drop down to $50 million per the bill as introduced, but a sliding scale would apply so that the larger the overall investment is, including additional property that came in later years, that threshold of property below which taxes are still applied would rise to $100 million, depending upon, you know, how large the overall investment was. So even though the bill is introduced and these amendments would not affect any current strategic investment program, future investments in urban areas like the ones we've seen in Portland metro area would essentially be treated just as they have been under this program. But smaller projects, both in urban and rural areas, would be allowed greater feasibility to use the program and with more meaningful tax savings if they're of a smaller size or in the right location. And with that, I'd say the department is fully in favor of the bill if amended with the Dash 2s or as introduced. Thank you.
Okay. And pardon me for interruption. Representative Butler here. And since he needs to go, I'd like to close the work session of House Bill 2349 and then open a public hearing and a work session of the 2399.
Mr. Chairman, this is kind of an unusual situation because this is we're doing a review only of House Bill 2399. The bill's not in our possession. It's in the Committee on Revenue. So under House Rule 9.04, Section 4, we are reviewing it. House Bill 2399 requires the governor to obtain approval of the Legislative Assembly prior to approving citing any tribal gaming establishment on lands acquired by an Indian tribe after October 17, 1988.
And I requested this bill to be in our possession. As long as we have it, it is in our possession until it returns to you. All right, and Representative Butler, glad to have you with us here this
morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tom Butler from House District 60. I appreciate the opportunity to come forward today to testify relative to House Bill 2399. As your committee administrators indicated, House Bill 2399 and its vestiges rests in the purview of the Revenue Committee and has, by action of the House under House Rule 9.01, parentheses 4, with my consent, been allowed to come over for a brief examination in your committee. Colleagues, I, in addition to representing the Burns Paiute tribe within my constituency and in House District 60, I also serve very proudly as a member of the Commission of Indian Services for the State of Oregon, and recognize and want to publicly acknowledge my appreciation for the good work and services that those fine folks do for all of the tribal members that reside within the State of Oregon, within the United States. In that regard, Mr. Chair, I'm very, very anxious about the information or the proposal within House Bill 2399. I'm concerned that any attempt by the legislature to direct the governor to attempt to unring a bell, that's pretty tough to do with regard to so many things and actions which since October 17, 1988, that have relied upon, and we've got contracts in and construction completed and other contracts which are ongoing as a result of the actions of the legislature. Certainly if we did not openly approve the actions of the governor, we've basically given tacit approval, and we've ratified his acts every time we've joined together in legislative assemblies since the year 1989. And so we have a pretty good history of the fact that we've been continuing to ratify the acts of the governor without challenge relative to the establishment of gaming establishments by approval of the governor and by mutual agreement with the various tribes, one of which, not the least of which, would be one of the more recent actions relative to the items in the Columbia Gorge. We understand that Kenita, as a casino, a tribal casino, as part of this agreement, would go away, and that a new facility would potentially be constructed in the Columbia Gorge. While I personally have no interest in gaming itself, I do have an interest in the welfare and the well-being of my tribal nations within the state of Oregon, and I will encourage you to take into consideration that when we attempt to unwind yet another treaty with our Native American brethren, that I think that it would be inappropriate for us to take this action, and encourage you not to take any action to the affirmative that would lend any additional weight to an attempt to unring this bell. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Any questions from the members? No
thank
questions.
You.
Okay, I have a couple of questions, if I may. And Representative Butler, thank you very much for your concerns and welfares of the American Indian nine tribes in our state. And my concerns is also the same, that not only I'm concerned Indian tribes, but I have deep concerns the welfare of the population, of the total population of the state of Oregon. And I'm not sure whether you close contact with some of the people who has been suffered by this installation of this gambling in our state. Even when I was talking to, when I having a haircut, usually taxi drivers and barbers, they know what's going on in their community. And they, the person told me, the person knows many of them already bankrupt. And then they had the person happened to be a lady, had a two house, a nice husband, and lost all the money. And then at the last, she lost her husband too. So she moved out of the state. And this is not one incident, it's a statewide that the thousands of people in our state are having such problem. And then I respect the American Indians so being of their nation. And when they do their own casino installation in their own compound, I have no objection to it, but at the same time, they are coming to the Cascade Lock area, which is owned by in that area or state, this is the off Indian reservation compound. My concern is when they are coming to one area, you will see that when the camels that their nose into the tent, the whole body will be coming in just a matter of time, and then they are closing into Portland area everywhere. When one Indian tribe is coming into the Cascade Lock, others will come into other areas, and eventually that will be swamped of our state. And also, if you could answer me, a second question. Our constitution, that the Article 15, Section 4, clearly state that the Oregon legislature that they cannot approve of this casino, and also they prohibit the casino in our state. That's the constitutional duty. When we sworn in as a representative, we sworn in to uphold the constitution of our state, and the constitution clearly state that they prohibit casino in our state. I'm wondering if you kindly respond to some of the questions I raised.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, let me say that I do appreciate your honoring the tribal sovereignty of the tribal nations in the state of Oregon. And as to your first question relative to compulsive and problem gamblers, I want to bring to your attention that because of the budget crisis under which the state is laboring, we have continued as a state to cut our resources that are available to compulsive and problem gamblers, not just in terms of real dollars, but in terms of brute numbers of bottom line dollars in the last several sessions. And some of your members have been here for some of those special sessions, Mr. Chair, including yourself, and you know the amounts of money that we've cut. At the same time, the tribal nations have continued to increase and enhance the amounts of money that they have committed for problem gambling and compulsive gamblers in the state. So in that regard, it's very difficult for this pot to be calling that kettle black. I'm really troubled with the fact that while we have been enjoying the benefits of the lottery, and there's no question about it, Mr. Chair, the state of Oregon and its budgets have become addicted to the gambling business. I'm sorry to have to say that. But in that regard, I appreciate the fact that there are compulsive gamblers out there, and I appreciate the fact that it does destroy lives. In that regard, though, I would take a look at those who have demonstrated their ability and their willingness to come forward and be good partners in our communities. And in these communities in which we find these facilities and installations, I rather than go with the personal stories, and we know that they're devastating. I've got a business associate that I've been associated with for over 35 years in the business in Eastern Oregon, and a member of his family is addicted to gambling. I guess we joked about it early on, but we don't even joke about it anymore. We used to say that his wife would drive down to Las Vegas in a $60,000 car and come back in a $200,000 bus. Today, that's a reality in their family because she's been able to fritter away probably most of that fortune, and so I'm very anxious about that. But I want you to know that she does not do that. The majority of her gaming that this particular person does is in Oregon lottery, and Oregon otherwise they approved non-tribal gaming operations. And so while, again, I spoke against the lottery from its very beginning, would like to, and with you, Senator, joined in an attempt to try and return Oregon to a non-gambling state, I also have to recognize, and that's as to your point number two, and I appreciate your investing in me an opportunity to answer a constitutional question, because I'm not a constitutionalist, I'm not a constitutional lawyer. I really know very little about the constitutions other than I know that if we would live by the golden rule and lived by the Ten Commandments, that we'd all be much better off. We wouldn't have to have a constitution around, but because there are some of us that choose to push the law, then unfortunately we do get into a situation where we've got to come back and examine the constitution. In examining the constitution, one thing happened when Oregon went to gambling and the lottery, and that is that once we opened ourselves up for a gambling and lottery state, then basically we opened the doors under the tribal agreements and treaties which we have previously heretofore held as being valid, and agreed basically to hold ourselves to a standard of that of the federal government as controlled by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And it's my understanding that that by submitting ourselves, and that wasn't something of a legislative action, that was in fact a change to the Constitution, that the people of the state of Oregon have not just voted on once, but on various times have ratified the utilization of the resources which were originally intended for economic development under the original gaming laws of the state of Oregon, as constitutionally changed by the voters. But it's my understanding that when we did that, we also then opened up those doors which would allow the Bureau of Indian Affairs to work with those sovereign nations within the borders of the state of Oregon. And if you want to play a little geography test, I used to play this test before I came to state government. I'd say, folks, can you name me a country of the world which has all the way around its borders the same other country? And probably Representative Merkley knows who that is right off the bat. There is one nation in this, one sovereign nation with its own sovereign government that has, and there's probably more than one, but it's Lesotho in South Africa. They pulled out the tribal nation, I think they're part of the Zulu family, and they've made that a separate nation. And it's a fairly significant nation amongst the South African countryside. But in that regard, in the state of Oregon, now that I recognize what we have here, we have 9 sovereign nations surrounded by the state of Oregon territory on all sides, and we honor and respect that sovereignty. And so in that regard, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would just submit to you that under the Constitution of the state of Oregon, when the voters adopted an opportunity to game and gamble under the lottery program, then we also subjected ourselves back to a different standard, and that is that the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the sovereign nation's rights then kick in, that they also have the right to come in and game and gamble. Mr. Chair, I just say this. I want to express my appreciation again for the good work that the men and women of these independent and sovereign nations do, because in many instances they come back to the state, come back to the governor, come back to the legislative and the other bodies to receive direction, to receive their instruction as to how they should conduct their operations, even though they are not bound by what it is that the legislature imposes upon them in many instances. But they have continued to come back and ask for the direction, and we have been in the government-to-government reach, outreach to these good folks. We've attempted to try and bridge that gap and make sure that they were part of our communities. And in that regard, Mr. Chair, I would say that when the people of the state of Oregon voted to abrogate the long-standing, and no tribal nations to that particular point had done anything more than what we were already doing in the state of Oregon, and that's a little bit of social gambling, that is some bingo and those kinds of things. And they didn't make application to go any further than that until the laws of the state of Oregon changed to open up gaming statewide. Then that put the state in competition with the tribal nations, which then allowed them the opportunity to fall back under. And again, a constitutional lawyer would have a much better grasp of that, which then allowed them the opportunity to go back and petition the ability. And I say petition, it's a federal long-standing federal law that they would have that opportunity to go back to their tribal customs and the other kinds of gaming.
Right, and thank you very much. And let me just reiterate that the Oregon Constitution is written, Article 15, Section 4, states legislative assembly has no power to authorize and shall prohibit casino from operation in the state of Oregon. I'm not the expert on English, but to me the language is very clear that they prohibit casinos in the state of Oregon. And I remember when I sworn in to uphold the Constitution, if I don't uphold the Constitution, and who is going to uphold the Constitution, including the governor, every one of us, we need to be reminded that we are sworn in to uphold this Constitution. I'm not against gambling at all. I'm not saying I'm holier than thou. And if the operation has to be, then it has to be in the right way. Change the Constitution and let's do it. At least my bill here, House Bill 2399, we are the representative of the people. And at least that the governor has a moral and constitutional obligation to consult with the legislature if there's any approval of the casinos in the land of the state. Then that is the right procedure as far as I'm concerned. Out of that concern, I introduce House Bill 2399 on the current we are discussing. And we need to be reminded, I don't know why the legislature's bodies are so quiet on this very important issue. And the cat's out of the bag, they are coming so quietly, and eventually that we got you. And the one coming in is going to come, others many together in the later on. And I'm deeply concerned. The public welfare, the citizens of our state, continually fleecing with the most vulnerable people in our state by this gambling installation. That is my presentation. That's my reasoning for it.
Look, Mr. Chair, I appreciate that, and if I may respond, I as I understand your reading of the Constitution, that the legislature shall not authorize the casino-style gambling, but in your bill, Mr. Chair, the House Bill 2399, it provides that that the legislature would assemble to determine whether or not it will approve the gaming establishment of the governor, and that would have to obtain that approval from the legislature. And so, Mr. Chair, respectfully, I would submit to you that under Article 15, subparagraph 4 of the Oregon State Constitution, that perhaps the legislature would still not have the authority without a constitutional referral, that we'd be given the authority to approve these facilities, because, as I say, it's my understanding of a reading of House Bill 2399 that what it would do is it attempts to authorize the legislature to come in and have to exercise that authority. Again, while I recognize that this is an issue relative to the sovereigns, I think that we officially gave up our right to, as a legislature, legislate and to regulate sovereign gaming within the state of Oregon, within those tribal reservations and those tribal lands that have been ceded to those folks or that have been subsequently repatriated to the nine tribal nations. And Mr. Chair, while I would like to return to the days when we had no gaming in the state of Oregon, whether it be scratch-offs or video games or those kinds of things, I would just say that I remember the days when California itself was a state free from even dog races, that it was a state that could claim that it was only washed on the west by the Pacific and cleaned on the east by Nevada, but that's no longer true.
All right. If there's no further questions, I just want to thank you for your kindness to coming to testify, and also for lending me this bill to my committee.
Thank you very much.
Yes, appreciate it.
Return it to me unrumpled, and we'll consider the land a very good opportunity for you to examine it, Representative.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Okay. Is there any person like to testify on House Bill 2399? Is there any assigned paper?
Let's have one.
Okay. Yeah.
Oh, did you find one?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Thank you. Why did you get one? We have a lot of problems with violence.
Thank you, Chairman Lim and members of the Trade and Economic Development Committee. My name is Michael Mason. I'm the lobbyist for the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs Reservation of Oregon. I've been an attorney practicing Indian law for the last 22 years, and my specialty is, actually one of my specialties in the specialty of Indian law is Indian lands issues. So I am bringing testimony to you regarding 2399, House Bill 2399. Needless to say, the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs is strenuously opposed to this bill. We've spent 8 years getting to yes on this issue. We've rejected three sites in a very public process for environmental reasons, sometimes just because the site was unpopular, not an environmental issue. But we have worked very diligently. The tribes have worked very diligently to find a community that actually wants to have this facility, and we're working very closely with that committee. And as you look at it, the 75-page long compact that's been negotiated over a period of a year, you'll see that the tribe is, the governor is actually, the governor and his team are very, very good negotiators. If you look at just the percentage that the state gets out of net, but also the fact that many state laws for the first time are being applied to a tribal gaming facility. Whether it comes down to minimum wage, some of the labor laws, some of the important labor laws. But I don't want to take a lot of your time with this. I do want to try to clarify one point of, you know, the issue, and I take very seriously the oath that I've taken to the Constitution. I've taken the oath to the U.S. Constitution as a former federal employee and an oath to the Oregon Constitution as well as the Idaho Constitution because I'm licensed in both states to practice law. And one of the things when you look at the U.S. Constitution, it's not, there are some provisions that aren't that complex. The Congress has the power over Indian commerce. We normally talk about the Commerce Clause, but in that Commerce Clause, that Interstate Commerce Clause, there's also a provision about Indian commerce, commerce with the Indian nations. And it's under that authority, which was pressed for by George Washington at the Constitutional Convention to avoid a civil war between Massachusetts, Connecticut, and New York, which were contesting over the same land in the Ohio country, saying it should be part of their state. He said, we have got to stop this. The Congress has to handle commerce with the Indian tribes. The Congress has to decide what lands will be sold, what lands will be in the hands of Indians. So this is a very important provision in our early history, but it remains important today, and it is under that provision that the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act was passed. And that act is very clear. It doesn't say anything about the legislature approving land going into trust for tribes. Prior to that act, it was merely the Secretary of the Interior's determination, and certainly the Congress could step in and make a determination about what land went into Indian trust with the United States. But with the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, this power to decide was shared with the Secretary of the Interior and the governor. And it specifically says the governor. It doesn't say, you know, anybody else. So I don't see how this bill would have effect is another issue. But when you talk about the oath to the constitutions, it's to the constitutions, and it's to the U.S. Constitution as to federal law, which is the supreme law of the land, and that includes the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act and the treaties with the tribes. So I'd be happy to answer questions or actually turn it over to Mr. O'Connor.
First. Right, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Tom O'Connor. I'm director of the Oregon Municipal Electric Utility Association. The city of Cascade Locks is a member of our association, one of the smallest communities in Oregon, one of the smallest municipal utilities in Oregon. I just wanted to be here to stress for you that the city of Cascade Locks has been working in partnership with the Warm Springs folks for some time now. The city is in absolute support of this project. It is within the city limits of Cascade Locks. It is the community there has been hammered over the years, like I'm sure some of the other communities in New newer districts by the collapse of the timber economy. There used to be three mills in Cascade Locks. They are no longer there. The Columbia River Gorge Act has severely restricted the kinds of activities that can take place in and around the community, and this is an opportunity for tourism, which is the really the one economic opportunity that this small community has. So I just wanted to be here to express the support of the project and the opposition to this bill from the elected officials in Cascade Locks. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Nelson?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have a question of you and the good administrator. This law would go into effect after what date? After 90 days after we leave or what?
If the government signs it, then it's going into effect right away, I guess.
Unless otherwise specified, the laws that you passed this session would go into effect January 1st, 2006.
And it doesn't say here, but I'm assuming this would apply to transactions after that date. It's not retroactive, like to the one that's just been approved by the governor.
Mr. Chair, without getting into constitutional issues or retroactivity, I think the law would go into effect January 1st, 2006, and at that point, this would go into effect. For decisions before that, this law would not be in effect.
So it only affects decisions by the governor after January 1.
I'm not sure that the interpretation of the law yet on that one. That's my opinion.
Can we ask you if your intent was for the law to take effect?
And my intention is to affect the including the Cascade Law. Mm. That was my intention, but I'm not sure how this one will be interpreted. So that is still not clear to me yet.
I guess I would recommend that you talk with your chief attorney and determine what language needs to be in here if it's not already in there to accomplish what you want to accomplish. I'm not sure that it does accomplish that, but I'm not.
I don't either.
Well, Mr. Chair, could I ask one more? Because kind of by the way it reads, I mean, we'd have to go back and reapprove every gaming establishment since October 17, 1988, if it's retroactive, right?
That's right.
So, the way I presume, it would have to be future. And the way the bill also reads, it says only on lands acquired by an Indian tribe. So, lands that haven't been acquired by them that they get a lease on, are they can go ahead and do that. Go ahead and build a casino if they were able to do so.
As long as that the land is registered legally under their authority, yes, I have no problem.
If they hold the deed,
yes,
in other words.
Yes, of course, yeah. All right. Any more? Representative Dallam?
Yes. My question's for Mr. Mason. I've been waiting to ask somebody that's new Indian land law these questions for a long time, and finally to find them in a venue that is germane is exciting to me. In the Trans-Mississippi West from 1855 to 1965, as Native American land holdings diminished, to your knowledge, was there ever state involvement when land moved out of Indian control and into the dominant cultural control?
Chair Lim and Representative Dahlem, there was not direct state involvement in any of those situations. This was done. There were a number of congressional acts, most notably the Dawes Act or General Allotment Act. There were quite a number of agreements and treaties made that diminished reservations. But those were federal, those were agents of the Congress that were sent out to negotiate those treaties and agreements.
From the Treaty of 1855, the Dawes Act, right on Indian citizenship in 1959, any of those ever with the change of responsibility involve a relationship between the state and the federal government?
Not in terms of Indian lands, sir.
Thank you. So when we come from 1865 and the process starts a slow drip and lands move out of non-Native American control and back into their control on other than reservation situations, in other words, the establishing of trust land, was there ever a relationship between the state and Native Americans as opposed to the myriad of relationships between the federal government and Native Americans?
No, sir, there was not.
And as these trust lands are developed, when land moved back into Native American control, or tribal control might be a better term, were the rules and regulations when that land moved into tribal control very specifically limited and modified as those little pieces of property moved back under Native American control?
Well, that varies, Chair Lim and Representative Dahl. That varies. There are a number of restoration acts, so-called restoration acts, the Grand Ronde Restoration, Siletz, Coquille, Kuzlow, Umpqua, Soyuzla, Klamath, Cow Creek, Band of Umpqua. Those have some specific application of, well, they have application of state law, but under a federal statute. But this, again, is not application of state law to any land acquisition. It's application of state criminal laws on the reservation. So that's a different matter. For the most part, there was no application of state law at all, and that's the case with the Warm Springs, some of the Warm Springs allotments. As you well know, there is Warm Springs Trust land in near the Dalles, next to Hood River, on the John Day and the Deschutes Rivers. There's quite a bit of acreage that individual Indians had held in trust for them by the United States, but there was no provision for applying state laws to those parcels.
As I briefly read your testimony, all of those provisions for trust land into Native American holdings have been followed to this point in assigning the casino.
If I understand your question correctly, you're referring to what would happen when the land goes into trust from the Cascade.
And we followed all provisions of land moving from private holding to trust status in citing this casino.
Yes, that's great. What's interesting about this, and I think unique, is that we are actually following all of the requirements of, or substantive requirements, I should say, of Oregon land use law. I believe the procedural ones will be followed as well, but we certainly are following all the substantive ones. We're in an industrial park. It's already zoned for this use. We'll be following the federal National Environmental Policy Act. I learned the other day, I was a little crabby about this, but I learned the other day that right now we don't have to do one environmental impact statement. We have to do two environmental impact statements for this project. One, so there is abundant public input into this process, perhaps more than any other project in the history of the state.
And the next steps will be...
Hold on.
One more question.
Yes.
And I will, but where I'm going with this is the next steps in the process. And these steps were established as early as 1855 and have been followed to 1865. And now with the change in direction right up until 2005, and that is... usually through the Secretary and sometimes the President of the United States. So this would be, my question would this be the first time that the state has inserted itself with an approval from a legislative body?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Right. Any questions? If not, and thank you very much. And yes, Michael Lynn.
Good morning, Chair Lim.
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Lang, Conservation Director for Friends of the Columbia Gorge. appreciate the opportunity to provide testimony on House Bill 2399. In February, the committee, of course, held a hearing as well, and I provided some written testimony. Unfortunately, due to the short notice, I wasn't able to provide anything in writing, but I would like to make a few remarks about this bill and some of the statements that have been made here today. As you all know, on or around April 6th, the governor signed a compact to, I shouldn't say allow, but let's just say to move forward an off-reservation casino within the Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area in the town of Cascade Locks. And that compact, we understand, was transmitted to the Secretary of Interior on or around April 8th. The Secretary has to approve these compacts as well. She has roughly 45 days to act on it. If she doesn't act, the compact goes into effect. So that is the process that we're within right now. As I believe Mr. Mason alluded to, there's also a separate process by which the tribe, for these off-reservation casinos, they have to acquire the land, then apply through the Indian Reorganization Act to transfer these lands into trust to be managed by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and also apply for an off-reservation casino as well. It is our understanding, this is relatively rare, first of all. We understand that only three of these have been approved nationally, and one has been denied, I believe. So it's fairly rare. We're not experienced in this area of law. We have to go ask experts, how does this work? You have two seemingly parallel federal processes, and then NEPA falls over the top of it. As we understand, NEPA will apply to both processes. They'll be combined together, and there will be an opportunity through the National Environmental Policy Act for citizens to be involved in that process to weigh in on what the environmental effects will be. You may have heard yesterday there was an announcement here in the Capitol by Kelly Clark, who is representing a group of citizens in Cascade Locks called No Casino, Cascade Locks, that they are challenging the compact as being invalid based on its failure to comply with provisions of Oregon's Constitution. The lawsuit is, we understand, and I just had a quick look at the complaint, raises the constitutional prohibition of casinos. It's already been discussed here today, and also the separation of powers requirements in the Constitution, claiming that the governor does not have the authority to approve a compact without legislative approval. And I think that goes to the heart of the bill, 2399. And there was an article in the Oregonian this morning about it, and I think that some of the comments, first of all, by Governor Kulongoski's representative, Marty Lynn Sadhoff, said that, well, gaming's already allowed in the state, therefore, you know, and we have a state-run lottery, therefore the federal law requires the state to negotiate with the tribes to offer them their own games. And then Mr. Mason, who just spoke to you a moment ago, said that, well, if we want to get technical, the Legislative Assembly has no power to authorize and shall prohibit casinos from operating in the state of Oregon. That's right out of our Constitution. And then says, it doesn't say the governor. Now, we've heard this from the governor's staff as well, that, in fact, from the Honorable Governor Kulongoski himself about a year and a half ago, it says legislature. That doesn't apply to me. And it's startling that there would be an interpretation that the constitutional prohibition of casinos in the state of Oregon doesn't apply to the governor of the state. And I guess we're going to have to ask a court of law. Now, we're not involved in this lawsuit, but No Casino Cascade Locks is going to ask a judge to tell us, well, what does the Constitution mean to us? How does it involve the separate branches of Oregon's government? What authority does the governor have? In fact, does the legislature or is the legislature required to participate in these decisions? And then the big question, are casinos allowed in the state of Oregon? Mr. O'Connor also mentioned that the Cascade Locks is an absolute support of the casino. I think the fact that there's an organized group opposing the casino and challenging the very validity of this compact shows that the community is not speaking with one voice on it. In fact, the chair of the city council, Tiffany Pruitt, is an opponent of the casino and has gone on the record opposing the casino, and has also stood in front of numerous television cameras and has been all over the media saying that she does not support this proposal. So the community is split. stepping away from the... Well, not quite yet. I did want to address another thing, too, and that is the business impacts, the economic development impacts in the town of Cascade Locks. We know that the home shield industry, they build parts for windows, did not relocate to Cascade Locks based for two reasons. And one of those reasons was the casino and the potential for traffic impeding their ability to do business. They chose to move to the Dalles, which is doing very well as recently as far as economic development. Google locating a facility there as well. Also, the Green Hill Lumber Company had a lease in the industrial lands of Cascade Locks. Their lease was terminated by the Port of Cascade Locks to make room for this casino. There go 35 jobs right out of Cascade Locks, probably to the Dalles as well. So the Dalles is doing well because of the casino proposal on Cascade Locks. Unfortunately, Cascade Locks is not doing well. There's a shortage of industrial lands within the Columbia River Gorge as well. And what it appears, if this casino proposal goes through, that much of those industrial lands will not be available for blue-collar jobs. Instead, they'll be available for minimum wage jobs that casinos normally apply. And the compact does state that the tribes will abide and pay minimum wage based on state law in Oregon. Well, that's good, but I'm not sure if we should apply that, the casino will provide minimum wage jobs. That's great, as opposed to, $3 an hour jobs. I'm not quite sure how to read that. But fundamentally, what we're facing right now is a change in our state's policy over gambling and casinos. We, Friends of the Columbia Gorge and others, believe that we've established a balance in our state where we have 9 tribal casinos are located on reservation, and we have a state system, the lottery and everything else that provides revenue for the state, basically at a balance. By allowing one off-reservation casino in the heart of the Columbia River Gorge, it's going to open up the prospect of more casinos off-reservation moving into the urban areas within the state of Oregon. And fundamentally, we have not had the opportunity to discuss the future of gaming in the state of Oregon. Do we want off-reservation casinos in general? If so, do we place them in places like a national scenic treasure, the Columbia River Gorge? Or is there another way for us to assure that tribes have adequate revenue to generate services? Certainly that the state is reliant upon that revenue. The Representative Butler said that we are a state addicted to gambling for revenue. Solution to addiction, throwing more of the problem at it? I don't think so. I think that we have to consider as a state how do we treat the problem, not how do we increase the problem. So regarding this bill, it calls the question, should the state legislature be required to approve or not approve compacts with Indian tribes over gaming? And the question arose, too, do we look at this as being retroactively applied, or is it just in the future? I guess Friends of the Columbia Gorge had never looked at this bill as applying to compacts that have been established in the past. I think it's an interesting question. It raises some prickly issues about reopening compacts in the past. As far as the future, though, it looks as though Oregon's Constitution requires this. And we're very glad that, Representative Lynn, that you've introduced this legislation and that this committee is at least opening this dialogue up so we can explore what are the constitutional requirements in the state and where are we going? Are we really going to head down the path of off-reservation casinos in the state? Thank you for the opportunity to comment, and that would conclude my remarks. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there any person like to testify on this House Bill 2399? Hearing none. And we're going to close a public hearing on the 2399. And
you want to...
Okay. I'd like to take the 5 minutes to discuss the members of this committee, and so let's...
You want to speak with them individually?
If I could.
Or a small group. So if you want to deliberate as a group, you better stay on.
Can you palm that one off? Yeah.
If you want to speak.
Well, we can give you a note.
House Bill 2399. It was my choice intention to bring to focus to the public the awareness of this gambling problem. And then sometimes things going on without notice. And I want to make sure that we raise this issue and we voiced it, and at least I have a deep concern on this one, and I will continue to do so. And I haven't heard from the legislators anyone talking about on this issue at all. So I think we need to aware what we're going on. I think this is a warning bell as far as I'm concerned. My deep concern is not only not this alone, but there will be more coming in the future. And all the Indian tribes, and they are also asking more close to a Portland area, the major metropolitan area, and then how are we going to react when it's coming in? When one coming in, when you see one, you will see them all in the future. So that's my concern. It seems to me that most of the members of my committee members are not in favor of this bill to move on at this point yet. So that I will respect that, and so with that, the Vice Chair Merkley.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before you close this bill, I just wanted to say that I think that the issues you're raising about gambling addiction, about the state's addiction to gambling on a budgetary basis, are very, very important questions. While many of us may not feel that this bill is the right path to which to tackle those problems, I want to personally applaud your raising these issues, and I think there are many other important, productive ways that we might think about those issues down the path. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comment you'd like to make? Representative Riley?
Mr. Chair, yes. I would just like to second the Vice Chair Minkley's remarks. I also applaud your intent, and possibly there are ways that we can go down this road, but in the future.
Thank you very much. All right. Since there's no more comment. Yes. Representative Nelson.
Thank you for allowing me to speak on this. Of course, being 1/8 Cherokee, I have to say I might have had a conflict of interest. But I do feel that the casinos that we've had in the state have been good to us in that they have assisted in so many, many ways. Where I live, we have a corridor that is very dangerous, and thanks to Spirit Mountain in this case, they've made that Highway 18 much safer. There have been many fatalities part of their assistance. We also have a health clinic because of their support, the schools, almost every charitable venture. So I do want to thank our Native American groups for making those things possible and being good citizens. While I feel that we have alcoholics, we continue to sell liquor. I mean, we have restaurants, we continue to get fat. I mean, we have automobiles, we continue to drive faster. I want to be sure that you know I support the issue for anyone who has an addiction. And I think we always need to be sure, just like in those three instances I've just mentioned, we do, you know, we take a driver's test, you go to Alcoholics Anonymous, in every one of these activities, you go to the doctor and to the gym for obesity, but we do have corrective solutions, and I want to be sure that we do appropriate the right amount of monies to be sure we don't have a gambling addiction in the state. I want you to know I truly support you there.
All right. Representative Dallum.
I would like to thank you, too, Chairman Lem. The issue of the governor negotiating did trouble me, and I did look into that. And taught Western history for some time. What's happening became obvious to me, but I welcome your examination of that issue. I was satisfied earlier. I'm satisfied now. This has brought some interesting issues to the table, and I think we've all learned from the discussion. So thank you for your efforts.
Thank you very much. All right. Since that's done, and I'd like to close a public hearing on 2399. And I just want to thank you, each member, for making the comment on this issue. And I'd like to open a work session again at 2349.
You had Mr. Fish testifying.
Yes. Bob, was
about
could you come again? Give us, sorry, during your presentation.
Absolutely. My pleasure to be back here again. And I finished everything I had to say, and you know, I'm just here for questions.
On this dash amendment, do you have general support from the city and counties and all other groups?
I do believe that we have a representative from the city of Gresham. And
so, please, could you give us your version of the... Okay. Ron, would you like to make a comment on this one also?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Doris Penwell, representing the Association of Oregon Counties. We clearly haven't polled the counties on this issue, but it is very consistent with the direction we've been going in allowing local options toward creating economic development opportunities, and this is really a good use of the strategic investment program, allowing it all over the state.
Okay.
We support it on.
No, Ron, have you looked at the Adesto Amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ron Papsdorf. I represent the city of Gresham. I did see the Adesto Amendments this morning. I think the Adesto Amendments do look like a very good change and modification to the strategic investment program.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Any questions?
Mr. Chair, I don't...
Representative Nelson.
Sorry for being gone to speak on another bill when you went over this first. But I haven't asked you, but what I was thinking that I had written a note on was the extension of this program. Is that in here? Maybe I could ask Art. I had written a note that how long does this program last?
Is there a sense in it?
My question is, this a infinite activity? I mean, it's going to last forever, or are we going to review it at any time? Or, I mean, which is usually what we do.
Representative Nelson, Chairman, and members of the committee, I'm unaware of any operational sunset or other type of limitation on the strategic investment program as a statutory matter. But it is rather infrequently used, and it is a frequent matter for public discussion at this level and the local level. So I do feel it does get quite a bit of consideration. But no, it lacks any sort of sunset, and this particular bill and amendments would apply only prospectively, but at, you know, ad infinitum as well. Thank you.
Okay. All right. So, and with that, work session, right?
Yes.
Okay. And thank you very much. Appreciate it. So we have a dash amendment on us, and do we have a motion to adopt the dash amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I move the -2 amendment to House Bill 2349.
Representative Nelson moves to adopt the -2 amendment to the House Bill 2340. Any objection to adopt this bill?
Mr. Chair, all due respect to Representative Merkley, I appreciate what he was trying to accomplish with the amendments. I'm not going to support the dash 2. I'm going to support the bill, but I'm not going to support the -2 amendment simply for the reason that I think the reason that the bill came to us in the first place was that, first of all, this is an excellent incentive, but but maybe more importantly, it was structured too high and therefore was not hitting enough interested or potentially interested parties. My view on the dash two is that we are I should go back. We've substantially increased the incentive with House Bill 2349, but with the dash two, we've muted that to a degree, and we've added sort of a creeping an inflationary index to it. My point is, if this gets out of control because so many people, so many entities want to use that, that's great. Maybe we can adjust in another session, two sessions down the road. But I don't want to decrease the incentive. I actually want to increase the incentive. So I will not be supporting the dash two.
Okay, and I want to clear, is this dash two amendment, this is applies to this new programs in the future, or this will apply to the old one too? Do you have any idea? Art?
No.
Yes, this dash two amendment is applies only the future, not in the past, right?
Yes, the language which I would respectfully direct the chair and the members of the committee to is on page 3, line 23. It has what appears to me to be a perfectly clear prospective clause as far as saying that this is these amendments, as far as, you know, 12.5 and 50 million and the sliding scale. And this is exactly the same sort of language that's in the bill is introduced. It's just reserted here in view of the language that was deleted, and it makes it so projects, you know, that we, when we receive at the department on behalf of the Economic and Community Development Commission an application, it would apply to those applications in the future. So this bill, of course, wouldn't take effect until 90 days sign and die, or actually, I'm not sure if it doesn't take effect not until January 1st. I'll have to find my original copy of the bill.
So with that, any other objections to the objection of dash two amendment?
Yes, Art, on the dash two amendment, and I want to go directly to line 3.
Mm-hmm.
And it talks about the increase by 3% annually. That was not in the original bill, was it?
Representative Dallum, Chair Lim, members of the committee, the 3% increase has been in the statutes with this program since used to be 6%, and then it was reduced to 3% in the aftermath of ballot measure 50. So I think it was the 97 or 99 law inserted the language of 3%, where it had been a 6% growth rate in the past. So, you know, you go from 100 million in an urban area to 103 million, 106 point something, and so forth year after year, and that becomes your new threshold.
And that has always been that.
Yeah, that's in the existing law, as you can see. Well, you wouldn't see it here because this section of statute, but if you look on page 1 of the dash 2 amendments, line 12, you'll see in brackets the deleted text that applies that more simply. And this, of course, has to repeat it several times because of the differing levels that are applied.
Okay.
And just to follow up on the last time, to confirm, this would be, as currently written, whether amended or not, a January 1st effective date for this legislation.
And I want to be crystal clear, because we do have some confusion here. The issue was that when we went from 50 million to 100 million, that if you did not come, you could come to a fraction of that threshold, and there would be a cliff effect. This does take care of that, and it does not change anything in the bill except that it creates an opportunity for someone between 50 million and 100 million to enjoy the provisions of the law.
Well, Chair Lim, Representative Dow, members of the committee, the program as it works is sort of, let me see here. As your value of your project decreases, there's sort of it's sort of a natural threshold. If you're paying the taxes already up to that threshold, if the value of your project drops below the threshold, there's effectively no tax savings. But that's the mechanism of the law. What this does is it still actually preserves the 50 million as your low number, and for anybody whose project is below that, they would
they would enjoy the same benefit as the bill under the bill is introduced. Mm-hmm. What happens is you go up to a larger project size. So if you know, because some of these projects are in the billions, as you know, the you would gradually rise up to 100 million as your threshold, like it is under the current law, and that would vary really if you're in that 100 to 200 million level as far as the size of the overall project. After 200 million, it would just be 100 million again, and so you do decrease the benefit with the amendments for those relatively larger projects, and then it essentially removes the benefit for the much larger projects.
Vice Chair Barone?
I know we're under discussion. I have to ask a question. I have to be honest with you. This amendment is clear as mud to me. my bottom line question is, and I think you addressed it here, but I need it in clear language.
Mm-hmm.
Simply because I can't get my arms around this amendment fully. You've taken care of that inflation question, which I hadn't seen the original statute, so thank you for that. Bottom line question, is this increase tax incentives or decrease tax incentives?
Chair Barone? Vice Chair Broom, Chair Lynn, members of the committee, I feel that whether the bill is amended or not, that it does dramatically increase the incentive of this program.
Does this amendment, I'm sorry, does the Dash 2 amendment, I know the bill does, for sure, does the Dash 2 amendment increase or decrease tax incentives?
It increases the incentive value.
Above and beyond the bill?
No, not beyond the bill. It would make it less than, okay. It would have less impact than the bill.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Okay. Vice Chair Mokley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to add to the confusion. When we held our initial testimony on this, I raised the question on whether the change of the $50 million reduced the threshold at which people were eligible to participate, or whether it also had any impact upon the base rate on which corporations are taxed. And the answer in testimony was that it did not have the latter effect. And in fact, then when I looked into this, because my memory was something different, the legislative council, which has to take a close look at it, went to the other section, 307.123, that is affected, and said, yes, indeed, there was that unintended effect. So if you have a $1 billion project, the original bills presented to us would open up an opportunity for the $50 to $100 million, but we were under the understanding from testimony that it wouldn't affect the basis for, say, the $1 billion project. It turns out it did because of a reference in this other piece of law to the first piece of law, and so the $1 billion project floor would now be lowered from $100 million to $50 million. That wasn't the intention of the law as I understood it, nor was it the testimony we had before us, nor was it being sought by any of the large companies that apply for the very large breaks, and in fact could prove to be rather embarrassing to them in a situation where the public starts to wonder, is this something, this lower floor being slipped through, if you will, particularly because at that point we have a project pending. So I understand that the one project being applied for, that they were not seeking this effect, and therefore the Dash 2 does, I think, what everybody intended originally, and a little bit more, and that originally the intention was to open it up to projects below $100 million. This Dash 2 does the identical thing from $50 to $100 million. It establishes the participation threshold at $50 million and the tax floor at $50 million. Then, for those above $100 million, it was our understanding from testimony the tax floor would still be $100 million, but this actually lowers it down to $50 million if you're at $101 million, if you will, and gradually raises it till you hit $200 million and then leaves it at the $100 million just as the existing law does. So I think it makes it very consistent with the original intention of the bill. It also makes this nice little benefit. If you happen to be applying between $100 million and $200 million level, you'd actually get a lower floor, lower than the $100 million in existing law. So I think it's a nice balance. And while I understand my colleague vice chair's desire, I think this is pretty healthy in looking out for the microchip industry
in Oregon, and certainly would appreciate his support if that explanation helped at all. Thank you.
My intention of this bill, of this one, 2349, there has been no activity in the last 2 years of the application of this one. It's $100 million. So I'm lowering the threshold to $50 million. Possibly some medium-sized company might take advantage of this one. That's the whole intention. And so with that, and since there's been some confusion, just please call the roll that the members supporting House Bill, that the adopting the Dash 2 amendment to the House Bill 2349 say aye, those opposed say no.
Yeah. Representative Brown.
Aye. All right.
Aye.
Representative Down.
Aye.
Representative
Murphy.
Aye.
Representative
Nelson.
Aye.
Representative Riley.
Aye.
Chair Lynn.
Aye.
All right.
So this has approved, been unanimous, and it's passed, and this is a subsequent referral to the project committee, the right?
Two.
Oh, yeah. Revenue committee.
That was just the dash two, wasn't it?
The bill now,
right? And now
so we're now to the bill, right?
Now to the bill.
Okay. Yeah. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2349 as amended
to the floor with a 2% recommendation with a subsequent referral to the revenue.
To the revenue department with a due pass recommendation.
Yes, and Representative Nelson moves House Bill 2949 with the amendment to the floor with a 2% recommendation with a subsequent referral to the budget committee, which was the Ways and Means. All right. And
go there first.
Revenue or Ways and Means?
That's got to Ways and Means first.
Revenue committee. Sorry. That's
Mr. Chair, one question.
Yes.
Do you want to go to the floor, and then if it passes on the floor, it goes back to the revenue committee or to the revenue committee?
Mr. Chairman, I think I'm the one that injected this bit of confusion into the committee's deliberations here early in the session, and I just want to make it clear at that time. I wanted to make it clear that you're recommending do pass on the floor. In the meantime, it has to go to the revenue committee. Some people might interpret it as being that you're recommending to the revenue committee that they do pass it. But
well, of course we do.
Recommending
we wouldn't be there.
You're doing both.
That's right.
That's why we say do pass as amended.
Got to go to revenue first.
Yeah.
Right. So what I did is correct one?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you for approval. All right. And any discussion? If not, please call the roll.
Yes. Representative Buckley.
Aye.
Representative Dow.
Aye.
Representative
Murphy. Aye.
Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Representative Riley.
Aye.
Representative
Brown. Aye. Chair Lynn. Aye. And House Bill 2349 and with amendments and passed. And so I'm going to close a work session on House Bill 2349. And I'd like to open a work session on the House Bill 3123. This is the incubator, the center, and I had a deep conversation with Representative Greg Smith, and he is the sub-chair in the Ways and Means of the Economic Development and Transportation, was it also? Yeah. Okay, economic development anyway.
Yes.
And so he wants to have this bill to his committee, which I don't have no objection to it. So it's up to us to report this. We have discussed this bill before. It's up to us to send to that committee with recommendation or without recommendation. And would you give us your thought on that issue?
Vice Chair Buckley.
Mr. Chair, I would like to send it with recommendation. I think that the testimony in support of supporting incubators was very strong.
I would second that. I thought the testimony was very strong, especially for incubator centers that are specialized within inner city and urban areas. I think they provide an excellent focus point mecca for developing small business and entrepreneurship.
Okay. And as you know, we have been discussing this bill, possibly rescinding to send to the Ways and Means and to the floor directly. That has been discussed last meeting, but apparently the members of this committee wants to send to the budget committee directly, not to the floor. I just want to make sure that point. All right. I see a lot of nodding. Okay.
Mr. Chair, just a question.
Yes.
Can you just explain a little bit further? I got a little confused there. Is Representative Smith on the budget committee? Did he request this bill to go to the budget committee now, or?
Yes, to the Ways and Means.
It goes to
the Ways and Means. It could go to his subcommittee.
Gotcha.
Maybe not. It's up to the Ways and Means to decide that.
Mr. Chair, yes. I could be wrong. My impression would be that he would want that simply because it's his bill and he wants to babysit the process to make sure it gets through. I don't want to misstate if that's really not what it is. But if this doesn't have a budget or a revenue impact.
No.
I know he's for it. I would assume that if we could get out here with a pretty strong showing, he'd be for that.
Okay.
He didn't tell me that directly, but that's an assumption I'm making.
Okay. So
and maybe let him
yes. Before we do further discussion, is there any precedent, Jim? Is there any precedent we could send it to the subcommittee, or it is we are obliged to the just Ways and Means?
Mr. Chairman, not the subcommittee. You would just send it to Ways and Means. We've been advised that you should be sending it to the Budget Committee if you wish further work on it.
Okay,
but you would not have the authority to send it to any particular subcommittee.
But then we can recommend it, though. No?
We recommend anything you want.
I don't know if there's any precedent for making a recommendation like that in your motion. We could.
Maybe we should try it, Mr. Chair.
We don't want to overstep our authority. And then let's send it to the budget committee and let them work it out.
That sounds fine. Okay.
So we have the bill. The House Bill 3123, and do we have a motion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair.
I would move House Bill 3123, I assume with a due pass recommendation to the House Ways and Means Committee. With a due pass recommendation.
It's a budget committee.
Oh, it is actually the budget. Okay.
Yes.
I amend my motion and would intend for the budget committee, not the House budget committee.
All right. And Vice Chair Boone, let them move House Bill 3123 to the budget committee with a two-pass recommendation.
Mr. Chairman, I wanted to explain that in terms of the technical part of what your motion will look like, we will request rescission of the subsequent referral to Ways and Means and that the measure be referred to the budget committee, and we will need to provide a letter to go along with that.
Okay.
So just telling you the technical parts of this.
Okay. Do we need to say that, or okay, can
no.
we do it?
Okay. That's what the motion will look like in the in your staff measure summary in your committee report.
Okay. So all we are ready to go, right? For a vote. All right. Yes. Those who support the bill to the budget committee say aye. Those opposed say no. Please call the roll.
Representative Downs.
Aye.
Representative Markley.
Aye.
Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Representative Riley.
Aye.
Representative Bruin.
Aye.
Representative Buckley.
Aye.
Chair Lowe.
Aye.
And House Bill 3123 has received the approval and a closed work session. House Bill 3123, if there's any other business to take care, hearing none, our meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much for your cooperation.
Is there a meeting, Mendy?
Yes.
There is.